ahead and get started. Thank you to those of you that are here with us this morning. My name is Suzanne Nasser. I'm a counselor in the Counseling and Career Development Center. I have with me my colleagues, Sharon Brennan and Jim Fino, who are here with us. What we're doing today is we are closing out our fall semester series of our One Book, One College. For those of you that have been following us, we've been reading as a community, as a college, as a campus community, the book We Believe You by Annie Clark and Andrea Pino. If you don't have the book, you can check it out here in the library, or you can purchase your own copy at the bookstore, because we're going to continue with the themes that are in this book in the spring as well. I'm going to encourage you to also check out the One Book, One College website, where pretty soon we'll be posting our events for spring 2018. So if you're interested in the topic of sexual violence, domestic violence, and want to continue coming to some of our events, please check out the One Book, One College website. And there's also an extensive set of resources for all of you as well, or for loved ones or friends who are impacted by sexual violence. We have some resources here from Center on Halsted. We also have some resources in the back there for resources on campus that you or others can take advantage of, okay? So today's talk, Understanding Violence Within the LGBTQ Community, again, is part of the One Book, One College program. And we are pretty honored and lucky to have with us Rachel Tillman from the Center on Halsted, who will review the unique and specific issues of domestic violence and sexual violence within the LGBTQ community and how they differ from heterosexual communities. The focus, again, will be on domestic violence, sexual violence, and hate crimes. And she will also provide us with tips and resources to those who have loved ones, friends, or for those of us who professionally work with the LGBTQ population and have been impacted by sexual violence. So I'm going to give you a brief introduction to Rachel, and then I'm going to turn it over to her. And if any of you have any questions or questions, we'll save some time at the end for that. Rachel Tillman, LCPC, is a psychotherapist who has spent the past 13 years in social services and community mental health centers, serving communities within Chicago, the suburbs, and the West Coast. Currently, she oversees Illinois' LGBTQ violence helpline within the Anti-Violence Project at Center on Halsted. The LGBTQ helpline is the only phone line in Illinois that addresses all forms of violence that impact LGBTQ and HIV-affected persons and communities. As the director of the helpline, she is keenly aware of the incidents and incidences of domestic violence impacting LGBTQ persons, and often presents her work as a trainer for 40-hour domestic violence certification programs. She also supervises and directs the Anti-Violence Project volunteer program. Clinically, she sees individual, couples, and group clients at Center on Halsted and helps them deal with the after effects of trauma and violence. Furthermore, Rachel supervises emerging clinicians within the behavioral health master's doctoral level training programs. She enjoys seriously getting out of town, same here, staring at walls, and pretending to get up early enough to make her bed each morning. She is also a proud auntie of three shortish humans. And you can read more about Rachel and her work at centeronhalsted.org/team. Okay, so thank you, Rachel, for being with us today.
Great. Is this, can you all hear?
Yes.
Perfect. Well, thank you all for taking time out of your day, some of you for coursework, some of you for curiosity, some of you because you occupy a similar space in the library. And I really want to honor you all for tackling this book. And I actually haven't read it, so I look forward to adding this to my list. But I'm also curious to hear about conversations that have emerged from the reading, and then that will continue to emerge next semester. So thank you all for valuing the work of, or the reality of violence and the subsequent work that that entails. I tend to have an informal presentation style, so I welcome questions. I might have to pause you for a moment or put a bookmark in that because I might actually address that a little bit later. But just for a little bit of housekeeping, wanted to say that this is an open space for those. Okay. I work at the Center on Halsted, which I have introduced a little bit, but I'll introduce again, is just to the left and the right, the arrows, is a community center in Chicago that specifically works with LGBTQ persons. And so we've been around for over 30 years. The Anti-Violence Project itself has been around since 1985, so for over 30 years. And I'm a therapist within the Anti-Violence Project, and then I run our hotline. So that's a little bit what I do there. And I like to start with this because regardless of how we enter this conversation, it's wonderful that nobody needs to wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. So this quote from Anne Frank hopefully can motivate us that regardless of where we are, we can take steps to stop violence, to prevent violence, and to recognize it, to recognize our part in it, to recognize how we unintentionally perpetuate it, and move from there. Okay, so my desires and goals for today are to review unique issues of violence that impact LGBTQ communities. I was intentional on it being plural. To learn some differences from heterosexual contexts. I'm gonna spend a little bit more time on domestic violence and hate crimes than sexual assault, but I will get to it. And then hopefully you'll leave with some tips and resources. So are there other desires or goals that you all have for our conversation today? Okay. And that's okay if some emerge. So just some guidelines, just because this tends to be a difficult conversation. So just want to prioritize your presence and engagement. So if you need to step away, take a call. If you need to take a call, if you could step away. And, you know, I take notes on my cell phone, too, so that's fine. But if you could refrain from side conversations just so we can stay engaged. So this more deals with if you're having difficulty with understanding some of what we talk about, to ask if it's okay to talk about it and to more ask for an ally to explain something versus somebody who's directly impacted to explain how they're impacted. So that's what this guideline gets at. So in the example I use is if you have difficulty with some of the bathroom laws, try to talk to a trans ally or a cisgender person first. Does that make sense? So it's like I as a white person don't want to go to a person of color and say, like, why were you offended by this? I might go to somebody else if I tend to be a little not as informed. I might go to somebody, a non person of color. And then respect the person's experience as their own. So we're going to talk a lot about the LGBTQ experiences, but even those vary. So a person's experience is their own. So again, what do these letters stand for? Does everybody know what they stand for? Is that common knowledge? And it's okay if it's not. But I'll say that LGBTQ tends to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and that's not transsexual, that's not transvestite, or transgendered, that is transgender. And Q can be multiple. It can be queer. It can be questioning. You often will see others that are I for intersex. And so some people used to say hermaphrodite. That's not a word that we use anymore. We use intersex. Let's see. A tends to be asexual or can be known as ally. You might have seen P, which means pansexual. You might see two, which is two-spirited. But we'll just stick with these to just keep it a little bit more succinct. And why not just say LGBTQ? Specifically because it's really a rainbow, but it can mean there's no one way to define what the LGBTQ community is. There's so many varied experiences. So we try to more just say LGBTQ communities to just recognize the plurality and the variety and the diversity. So how many of us are there? So in Gallup in 2010, let me get my glasses on, there are people, again, this is a self-report, 2012. 4 years later, that bumped up to 4.1. So that would mean 10 million Americans. Approximately, one and a quarter million more compared to 2012. And millennials moved from 5.8 to 7.3 in 2016. So millennials, again, those defined as born between 1980 and 1998, drive virtually all of the increases observed in overall LGBTQ self-identification. They comprise about 58% of LGBTQ identified adults. It could mean they have more access to the survey technology to fill out the Gallup polls. So there could be a number of reasons why this data is the case. And LGBTQ identification is higher among women. So what we see, too, is racial and ethnic minorities now account for 40% of LGBTQ-identified adults when they are just 33% of the U.S. population. So that means that any LGBT work must focus on people of color. It must not just be a sort of idea of the gay white male that we stereotypically think of. And so I point out that it varies by income. And so I know that kind of an old trope was the more educated you are, the gayer you become, because the more self-aware or the sort of slippery slope of liberalism that I was kind of indoctrinated in my upbringing of You know, the slippery slope of the more educated we become, the higher you make, the more chances are that it's going to make you gay. And it's actually, we see a higher percentage up here than we do in terms of income as well as education levels. So how should we change how we understand violence if LGBTQ populations comprise only 4.1% of the population? Ideas? So it's not even a fifth. So why should we understand it? Anyone even venture out? Because everyone's important, yeah, even 4.1.
I mean, one of the questions I was having, which you may or may not be addressing, is that I'm presuming that number is actually pretty low.
Yes, the numbers is likely, yeah. Again, it's who has access to the Gallup, who has access to the technology to fill out, absolutely.
Yeah, because, you know,
and who's comfortable reporting. Right. Right.
Usually, well, it's under 5% now, it won't be always.
It won't be always. Yeah, again, this number can change. So all good reasons. One of the biggest reasons is it impacts. So for example, domestic violence, we'll use this example, impacts. So although only 4.1% have declared themselves to LGBTQ persons are actually disproportionately represented in domestic violence. So that this is a lifetime prevalence rate according to the Centers for Disease Control. Even though this is over 7 years old, but basically 61% of bisexual women have endorsed having experienced rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner. That's nearly doubled straight women. So that's something we look at. So it's impacting more and bisexual men. It's impacting more than heterosexual men. So we look at it, you know, why is it important to study? Because they tend to be more impacted. And so a little bit deals with why do we study violence? Because why do we study violence with LGBTQ communities? Also because they're more impacted by privilege, power, and prejudice. So privilege being an unearned right or advantage or immunity granted or available, power being a capacity to enact a change. So power, again, is not necessarily of these three. Power is value neutral. It can basically tip the scale. So it's capacity to enact a change, capacity to make and enforce decisions, and prejudice, a set of negative unchecked beliefs. So where this comes in is with oppression. So power, basically prejudice and privilege plus power. And so LGBTQ communities experience different types of discrimination at different levels. So homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, heterosexism, which is different than homophobia, we'll talk about that in a moment, sexism, and racism. And there are so many other isms, but I had to fit them on the slide. Let me know if I'm going too fast, too. Good? Okay. So, heteronormativity, a systemic belief that heterosexuality and the binary gender, or male, female, are superior, normal, the default. So most persons are presumed heterosexual at birth. Parents often speak of their children's future romantic partners based on this presumption. I have an adorable four-year-old nephew. He can get away with murder because of his dimples. And what do I normally think when I think about his future romantic partners? Oh, some girl, he's gonna break some girl's heart one day. That's nothing wrong with me thinking that. It's just a sign of heteronormativity. So again, I'm not trying to shame us for thinking of these things, but just be aware of that. That's the kind of presumption. So to come out is, in a sense, to show otherness to what is assumed as normal. So I have to come out of the closet because I'm presumed something else than what I am. And what is normal is attraction to and desire for sharing lives with someone of a different sex. I purposely say different versus opposite, in part because people can have their people are, it's not just the binary of male and female. People can identify as transgender and or gender non-conforming and not fit in terms of an opposite. So we usually say different instead of opposite. Does that start to make sense? So heterosexism, the overall creation of institutions to benefit, that benefit heterosexual persons exclusively and or oppress LGBTQ persons. So again, heteronormativity is not as harmful as this. So I get to be a therapist without being assumed to be the lesbian therapist or the gay therapist or the queer therapist or the trans therapist. Does that make sense? Okay. Biphobia is the denial or bisexual erasure of sexuality that is fluid or desire for multiple genders. Because their orientation is not recognized as valid, they are often stereotyped as confused, indecisive, insecure, experimenting, or just going through a phase. So often this happens in straight appearing relationships. So when you have a female survivor and a male perpetrator, do you assume that both are straight? Oftentimes we get a lot of calls from straight appearing people, and it actually turns out that the female identifies as queer or bi. Transphobia, along with heteronormativity, the oppression that results from presuming children are born cisgender, and that to deviate from binary gender, male or female, or genital sex assigned at birth, is undesirable. This is what perpetuates the high homicide rates, which is highest amongst transgender people of color, and bathroom laws. How are we doing on time? Okay. So I'll just kind of breeze through this so that we can get a little bit more into the specifics of violence. But I spend time on this because understanding the layers of oppression helps kind of then, if you can get this, then examples can start to make sense. And you can actually come up with your own examples. So the four eyes of oppression: ideological, so a system or of beliefs or ideas. Institutional, using the laws. So ideological is philosophical. System of beliefs or ideas, institutional, using the laws, the legal system, the education system, public policy, media, social power to maintain that ideology. Then you have the interpersonal, the idea that one group is better than another and has the right to dominate, control the other. And then there's the personal or the internalized form of oppression. The oppressor doesn't have to exert any more pressure because we now do it to ourselves and each other. So let's kind of use an example of transphobia. Ideological, the creation and overall acceptance of a gender binary, male or female, that reinforces societal rigidity around any gender identity that falls within or out of the spectrum, particularly in regards to how a person should act and or look. That system that reinforces this is called heteronormativity or cis-normativity. So when I say cis, that means cisgender. Have people heard of that? No, okay. So cisgender, I'm not a gender studies expert, so I wish I knew the actual origin, the etymology of the word. But cisgender is the term that we use to say someone who is not trans identified. So someone who is trans identified, does anybody have a simple version of?
I'd like to think I've heard of all the different words, but never that one.
Never transgender?
Never cis.
Okay, so someone who does not identify as transgender is usually cisgender. Did you have an idea or you're just reaching? Okay. So someone who identifies as transgender, maybe they were assigned male at birth and they actually feel themselves to be more of a female. Somebody who's transgender, again, it's an umbrella, can be an umbrella term, can feel that they don't belong in one gender. Somebody who's cisgender usually, the best way to think of it as they identify with their biological, genital, brain sex.
What they were born with initially.
Yes, what they were signed with. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Does that make sense? So, secondly, institutional, the passing of House Bill 2 in North Carolina's legislature, a sweeping law that reverses a Charlotte ordinance that had protected transgender people who use public restrooms based on their gender identity. An example of this interpersonally, a cisgender individual taking upon themselves to police a transgender person's right to use a public restroom reflective of their gender identity through verbal or physical violence. Somebody walks into the bathroom and you say, "You're in the wrong one." That would be an example of interpersonal oppression. Does that make sense? And that can be a challenge because some places have very gendered bathrooms. But instead of saying, you could say, even saying, "Do you realize this is the woman's bathroom?" Someone who actually looks to your eyes as a male might identify as a female and they're just not dressed that day yet. And so then actually saying something like, "Do you realize you're in the woman's bathroom?" might actually be a form of oppression. And then internalize, an individual feeling that like their transition must look or present a particular way in order to be accepted or valid as transgender. So one has to pass, so within the gender binary, so a woman who still has a beard can feel like is inferior because they're not passing as a woman. Even that there's something wrong or not normal about themselves because they are trans. So again, we talk about intersectionality. That's kind of been the buzzword, thanks to Kimberly Crenshaw, right? And so that all of these factors come together of race, ethnicity, class status in society, sexuality, gender identity, able-bodied status, age, immigration status. But actually, what I'd like to think about is that it's not just intersectionality, it's about magnification. That somebody, it's not just the intersection of gender and race, it's not just the intersection of race and sexual orientation. It's that somebody puts on the fact that they are lower income, and then they put on another layer that they are English not as their first language. And then they put in another layer and they are trans. And so all these things magnify the potential oppression that they could face. So differences, let's talk about that. Okay, so for domestic violence, some of you might have heard power and control, the power and control wheel, the wheel of power and control. I didn't include the Duluth power and control wheel, but a lot of it is not just about who hits who, but who has more power over the other. But what we see is, yet power and control dynamics are magnified within contexts of marginalization. So for LGBTQ persons who are already face societal levels of oppression, those power and control dynamics are magnified. So I'd like to talk a little bit about violence because I know that basically the presentation title is Understanding Violence. And I want to say that, I know this is probably something that's assumed or taken or underappreciated, but violence is not violence. We think of violence as something as physical, a black eye, a bruised cheek, bone, a bloody lip, and really violence is just, is an assault on another person, whether that assault is physical, whether that assault is mental, whether that is solid or verbal. It's basically saying, you don't deserve dignity, and I'm going to take that from you. It entails consent. So we talk about consent and often more in issues of sexual assault. But consent can happen, violations of our consent happen all the time. They happen in the workplace. They happen in your car. You didn't consent to somebody like deciding to hit you. You didn't consent to your landlord being the way they are. So violence happens on multiple levels, and it's not just physical. Wanted to talk a little bit about this, why we still use domestic violence in LGBTQ communities versus intimate partner violence. In part because it captures relationships and families of choice that are not included in intimate partner violence. So somebody might have broken up with their partner, but they're still roommates because both of them can't afford to pay the rent separately. So they stay together, but they're technically not in an intimate partner relationship, but any violence that would happen subsequent is still classified as domestic violence because it happens domestically. So what we just saw on Sunday, unfortunately, domestic violence. So the shooter going into the church to look for his in-laws, that's domestic violence. So we say both. And how they work in LGBTQ relationships. So someone can be denying access to their partner's medical treatment, their girlfriend's or medical treatment, boyfriend's medical treatment, threatening to out the partner if they report the abuse to family, work, landlord, school, etc. Telling partner that if they report the abuse, nobody's going to believe them, and so then you do this. You say we believe you. Denying partner access to information about LGBTQ issues or forbidding them to discuss topics related to their sexual orientation or gender identity. You see this a lot in transgender, straight or transgender heterosexual, not transgender, transgender cis relationships. So usually a gay identifier, not even gay identifying, but a cis male will have a trans partner who dresses like a woman, who passes like a woman, and doesn't want anybody else to know that he's really, that his partner is actually trans. So we'll often say, why aren't you wearing your makeup? Why aren't you putting this on? To basically erase any sort of trans identity. Often this medical treatment can look like whether that's HIV medications or whether that's hormonal treatment. So often we see that with trans folks as well as those who have HIV. Telling partner that they will never find another partner who treats them better. This is also a facet of societal isolation. This is often the case with that same example of somebody will just think you're a freak. So often have cisgender partners telling their trans partner, nobody will ever appreciate you like I do. Threatening to reveal the HIV/AIDS status of a partner also deals with jeopardizing custody of children, threatening to jeopardize immigration status. So this actually happened in April, I think, a couple months ago in a Texas courthouse where a trans Latina went to get an order of protection, and her partner used it to deport her, which actually is illegal, by the way, but some judges don't know the law. VAWA, yep. They're covered. It's covered under the Violence Against Women Act under the U visa. But the thing is, somebody can't unlearn immigration status. A judge can unlearn that, and so even though they're covered, sometimes it really depends on a judge, and then it depends on a higher body then appealing that ruling and saying, the judge, you acted illegally. So even though we have laws to protect, it still doesn't prevent it always. Did you have a question?
So what makes it illegal that she is an immigrant and he, or because of the order of protection?
So in other words, someone, according to the Violence Against Women Act, basically does not criminalize someone who, regardless of their status. So they are protected, their status, their citizenship status is protected from it being a reason to arrest that person or to deport that person. So basically, because the Violence Against Women Act says if you report violence that's happened to you, domestic violence that's happened to you, you're not, then you don't also have to fear that you're going to be deported when you report that. Yes. Right. 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 Right.
But like you said, that's not always clearly in that case in Texas.
Right. 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 It's not always enforced. So it's not just the fear of deportation, but also they shouldn't have to fear continuing to stay with their partner. So again, using negative cultural stereotypes, machismo doesn't allow your whining, hush it up, using partners' reluctance to involve the police and knowledge of police abuse for people of color to discourage them from seeking help. So it's a sort of like, it's like if somebody, if you have two partners, both people of color, one can then use that sort of minority status to say, well, why would you want to report it? You know they're gonna kill you anyway, and so that can keep them from seeking help. Exploiting, and they can also exploit their partner's internalized response to homophobia, biphobia, transphobia. So if the partner already feels insecure about their sexual orientation or gender identity, they can really feed into that. Using slurs, hiding or throwaway hormones, clothes. Controlling the partner's gender expression, because you might have someone, you might have a gay couple, two men, cis-identified, and one of the partners says, I think I might not be a man. I think I might not be cis. And so then that partner might try to be discovering a different gender, and that and again, that could be a change, that could be, you know, any changes are difficult to handle, but if the partner still chooses to stay with them while their partner transitions and yet continues to throw away all the clothes, it's a sign that they are using abusive tactics with them. Again, like, I'm not saying that if somebody comes out that they need to necessarily stay in the relationship, but if, again, they've made the choice to stay in the relationship and they continue to do this, it's a sign of abuse. Again, isolation, fear of being outed, family isolation. They have overlapping friends. They may know the person providing domestic violence services at the LGBTQ agency. So you go to a rally with your girlfriend, you go to some rally downtown opposing the Trump Tower or something. And your girlfriend is really an activist. And then you don't know who you can turn to when she starts deciding to control your money. And when she decides to start undermining, well, you're not a good enough social justice advocate, da 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 da. Who do you go to? Because this person is well known in the community is fighting against justice. And so the community tends to be small. And so that's often a fear people have, is nobody's gonna believe them. This person would never do that to you because I just saw them at the Dyke March and they were just they're against misogyny and stuff. Why would they do any abusive tactics? So that's another. Abuser may be the only link survivor has to LGBTQ community. and my family's already disowned me, will I also lose my friends and community connections if I tell others that I'm LGBTQ? Can I find services where providers do not know me, my friends, or my family? So these are, so a lot of similar things that we see in rural communities, we see within the LGBT community. Again, this is a big problem for securing shelter for domestic victims of domestic violence, is does their ID have to match how they present? Are there shelters for my identity in the LGBTQ community? There really a lack of shelters for cisgender men or trans gender queer persons. Will I have to be the one to educate the survivor or the service provider? Will they believe me, take me seriously? Let's see, I'm gonna keep moving along. Yeah, will talking about my identity reinforce the ideas that LGBTQ people are inherently inferior or unhealthy? So there's also a sort of desire to keep dirty laundry within house just because of fear that it will reinforce. Well, naturally, you have two men, well, you're going to be more violent. Well, you know, that's inevitably wrong. So what did you think was going to come to you? That sort of, they don't want to hear that. Okay. Oh, this is another important one. Survivors are often placed in greater danger getting help because poor screening practices may allow the abuser to access shelter services, creating a conflict of interest for the victim. So oftentimes, you have two women, they need, one will present as a victim to just get access to the actual victim. All right. Again, how we like to assess is whose life is getting smaller. It's not who's getting the bruises, it's really whose life is getting smaller. All right. How much time do we have? Suzanne, how much time do we have?
Just asking about say a little bit more about what you mean by whose life is getting smaller.
Yes.
So the power and control dynamic.
Yes.
In terms of, okay.
Yeah, I can do that. I was just trying to be mindful of time.
Yeah. We can go about another 5 minutes and open it up for
Okay, perfect.
We can go till 12.
Okay. Okay, great, great. Because I know we've only really touched on domestic violence, but basically, sometimes it's important to, you will often see, to date, anecdotally, I've yet to see men being able to secure an order of protection for violence that's happened in a male-male relationship. To date, I've not seen a judge honor that. In part because all of the male victims that I've worked with are bigger. Physically bigger, so we tend to have this idea of the person who's bigger, the person who's more masculine presenting. In essence, that's kind of our idea that we're more comfortable with men being violent, with masculine defining violence. But instead of saying who's the more masculine, who's the more butch, who's the larger, who's unable to inflict harm, I like to think about whose life is actually getting smaller. Because sometimes it's not size, it's really not masculinity. It's really about whose life at the end of the day, who's having to compromise more, who's having to give up this and this, and this keeps getting carved off. Who's willing to accept blame more? And that is a sort of like whose life is just shrinking. Does that make sense? Okay, so I want to get to hate crimes. So we like to say, so what is a hate crime? A hate crime essentially is a crime that's been motivated by prejudice. So to reach the threshold of a hate crime, a crime has to have both been committed and convicted as a crime. So at the center, we don't say hate crimes. We actually say hate violence, because oftentimes things do not reach the threshold of being a criminal act or have been convicted as a criminal act, or having been convicted as a hate crime. So some people might say, well, we're going to prosecute this way, and we're not going to prosecute as a hate crime because this judge might see it as trying to get away, us being too harsh, and so we're actually going to prosecute it as just a crime. So that being said, that's why we differentiate hate violence versus hate crimes, because hate violence is a lot more inclusive of the reality that people can experience hate violence and actually hate crimes of hate with actually the law recognizing that as motivated by hate. So basically, a hate violence is any violence that happens because an identity or community identity that one holds. You can't change that identity, you are that identity. Some people are actually, acts of violence happen because someone else thinks they're this way. Someone looks Muslim, someone looks that sort of, that's often is seen. Someone looks gay. I've had a few clients that actually don't identify as gay, but because they were, endured slurs and they endured workplace discrimination because somebody assumed they were gay. So that is all encompassing in that. Any questions on that? We are actually seeing, despite increased legislation to, decreased legislation to protect civil liberties, we've actually seen a decrease in reporting of hate violence. So the irony is I'm sure you know of people reporting it since the election last year, since the campaign. We've actually seen, when it's become violent, we've seen an increase, but all the other, when it's not become like homicidal, we've actually seen a decrease in reporting. Because people are just kind of handling it on their own. They're not trusting sources to reporting sources. And so that's something that we're having to deal with is like after Orlando, after Pulse happened, the shooting that happened in June of 2016, you would have thought our phone would have rang off the hooks. It didn't. You would have thought after the election last year, our phones would have rang off the hooks. They didn't. So more violence is happening, but people aren't as keen on reporting it. I think it's because they're scared. This is homicides. So this is different. But these are things what I'm talking about are things that don't reach the level of murder. Okay, I'm just gonna breeze through this. So let's talk about this one. I want to kind of focus on. So sometimes we're asking a friend, what happened? And instead of saying like, well, what did you say to make this happen? Something that we can say is, tell me what sort of interaction you were having beforehand. Before they did this. So that's something we can say. So we can still ask questions to get a context when somebody talks to us about sexual violence or hate violence or domestic violence. We can just ask questions to get a context without doing what this looks to be as victim blaming. So avoid when talking about survivors. We don't want to just assume all survivors are women. Actually, 64% of our clients identify as male. So, which is actually the reverse from heterosexual sites. So, the majority of our sites identify as male. So, and avoid him when referring to abuser, as in the sort of classic male abuser, female victim. And instead, just kind of gender neutralize them and just say them. And again, assuming someone is straight when talking about male-female relationships, instead ask, well, how do you identify your orientation? All right, any questions? Thank you.
I just have a few questions about the center.
a few questions about the center. Uh-huh.
Not so much the violence, but I guess just like...
If you could use the mic so everybody...
Sure. In regards to like HIV, what does the center do to prevent the spread? And do you guys provide medication?
Yeah, so we have an HIV department, and I actually have cards for our HIV department. We do testing. We provide a pretty intensive linkage to care so that if somebody tests positive, we get them in for medications. And once somebody's viral load is pretty negligent, they essentially, there's really no harm as long as they're compliant with their treatment.
Do you feel that over the years it's getting worse, like the numbers increasing or decreasing to help prevent it? I guess is more my question, sorry.
So the question, did you all hear the question?
So basically, yeah. What do you guys do to prevent it, and do you feel that it's decreased or increased, the numbers and people being infected?
So we do a lot of outreach. So we're on a socio-global outreach. So we're on all of the, like we're on Grindr. We have apps to say, or we're on the apps to basically say, come in for free testing. We can do consultations with you. We do outreach to bars. We do street outreach. So in terms of, I don't know, like in terms of how much we're changing the lever, I know that we're changing the lever when it comes to most impacted communities are getting access to greater resources, and we have a lot of partnerships. One of our partners is Howard Brown Health, and so they have locations throughout the city, and so they're kind of, so whereas we're a community center, Howard Brown is a medical center for LGBTQ persons and HIV impacted communities. So I can't really speak to the decrease necessarily globally, but I know that we're having a greater impact on those most impacted or most vulnerable. I also know that funding has been challenging in this current administration on a lot of levels. So we've had a few programs cut to our youth outreach has been severely hindered because of funding cuts. So want to give the chance to have other people ask. But great questions, thanks.
Hi.
Hi.
So before I worked at Moraine,
Is your name Moraine? I'm just kidding.
My name is Shania. Before I worked at Moraine, I'm in the counseling center with my colleagues here. I used to work with on the west side, so I had clients who I would say you guys did really good work with. You guys in Howard Brown Health Center, so I really appreciate the work you guys do, that you all do, I should say, sorry. And I wanted you to speak a little bit to youth in this issue, because I know we talked a little bit about the demographics, but I know how much a lot of youth, LGBTQ youth, are affected in this, you know, and I saw a lot of the in the homelessness piece and all mm-hmm. of those pieces. So if you could speak a little bit about that, that would be good.
Yeah, specifically about any type of violence or just generally or? Okay, yes, great question. Glad you brought it up. So yes, youth are most impacted, and I wanna say that when we think of people being kicked out of their homes, that's an act of domestic violence. We often just think domestic violence is just romantic partners, but it's also when you get kicked out of your home, not because, you know, of behavioral things, but because you declare an identity, that's an act of domestic violence. So youth homelessness is particularly among trans-identified persons is pretty, I mean, it's almost like I would be surprised if somebody it's a strange thing when a family contacts us and says, we need help with our son or daughter coming out as trans, and I think, wait, you're still involved? Like, it's a shock to us. Stats-wise, I'm trying to remember because it's changed, but yeah, the life expectancy for trans identified people is, it's either 30 or 33. It's pretty young. It's pretty young because of the homicide rates, because of suicide rates, pretty high. And we often will see most of our trans murders have some sort of domestic violence component to them. So it's classified as hate violence, but it's usually someone that they knew, someone that they were on the street with. So often it has, even though it's hate violence, this is why it's important to look at the intersex, because a lot of it is by somebody who's like, I'm not okay with you being trans, and us being okay with them being murdered. So I know that funding has significantly impacted our youth programming, because so one of our shelters that deals specifically with youth, called, you might be familiar with it, the Crib, was shut down for about 2 months because of funding. So funding continues to be an issue. Center, we have a youth housing initiative, so we're trying to house basically youth between the ages of 18 to 25. And so we're using a cohort model. But again, it's because we have a lot of wraparound services with them. It's not mass housing. So there are a lot of youth that need housing. So housing, just survival is, I would say, is the case for a lot of youth, that violence is a daily thing. And then what's trying to be changed legislatively now is the felony ruling on name change, is why that's especially impacting trans communities is because, you know, if trans youth tend to be homeless, you know, what do you do when you're homeless? You need to make ends meet, you need to eat. So a lot of it is from sex work and drugs. And then what kind of violence classifications are those? Felonies. And you can't change your name after 10 years. And so it's challenging to help trans-identified persons who have made it. Like, they've survived past their life expectancy, but now they want to have a debit card that matches their name. They want to get work that where they want to get an interview where it's someone at the doors and like, who's John? Wait, you're Mariana. Like, why? Who are you? Oh, you're trying to defraud your job application. So we're not even going to look at you. So a lot of these trickle up into law and policies, but great question.
So do you guys provide like sanctuary, I guess would be the right word, should a transgender person or a queer person not thrown out of their home but a runaway due to circumstance? Could you guys provide maybe a shelter or maybe even just work at the center in order to gain a living?
Yeah, so the question is, do we provide shelter, sanctuary, I'm guessing in the non-immigration meaning of that, just kind of like a place to go to. Yes and no. So again, our housing program is again, because it's wraparound, it's not immediate, so we don't provide immediate shelters, but we do have a housing case manager who then works with our youth to get them shelters, so we partner. We have youth programs, so they can come in and get a warm meal Monday through Friday from 4 to 7, pretty much. And then we have our youth advocates that can see them throughout the day. But again, we on site, we don't have any shelter on site. Yeah. Great. Thanks for your questions. And I'll stick around afterward if you have other questions, too.
Well, my name's Alex. And
Hi, Alex.
Hello. I just had a question. What advice would you give to a LGBT person of violence that lives in a country where homosexuality or whatever else is illegal?
So the question is, what do you do? What sort of advice would you give to somebody who identifies as LGBTQ in a country where that is criminalized? Is that your question?
Yeah, just a victim of violence, hate crime.
Who's a victim? Because there are potentially two, there are multiple issues, but two streams of issues that, you know, there's the sort of criminalization of their identity. And then secondly, if they're currently in a violent relationship, that makes it hard. I would encourage them to contact various asylum agencies. I know we partner with an organization called the National Immigrant Justice Center, and so they work with refugees to get them asylum status. It's hard to say because I don't know the laws of each of those countries, you know, and sort of what remedies. I would encourage, you know, if you're trying to help a friend, I would encourage you to say, you know, look up what laws are in your area, and see if any remedies you have. And I would also caution them from coming out, from outing themselves, because, as an anti-violence worker, I'm more thinking about their safety versus come out, be your true self. I'm thinking, no, keep that in the closet because I want you to survive so that when you actually come out, like, you don't die in that experience. So I would, if they're like, no, I got to be my true self, I would just, you know, not tell them what to do, but just say, would that be safe for you? Or what would be the potential consequences if that happens? Do you have a community you can talk with? Have you heard of others in your community who have come out and who have not had any negative consequences? So again, you know, countries can have laws, they can be on the books, but if they, enforcing them is a whole nother reality, and then there's subcultures where things can exist. But I would just see if they're safe, again, see how safe they can get, see if they're currently in a relationship, if they can, like, leave that relationship. Or just say, you know, if their relationship is their roommate, and we all know it's not their roommate, but I would just say, hey, can you get another roommate?
Thank you.
Yeah, and feel free if you need more specifics, you can talk. You can talk to me. Thank you all.
Thank
you. Yeah.
Thank you again. Tuesday, November 14th, here in the library as part of the Celebrating Diversity Task Force Initiative. So tell others, come back yourselves. Thank you again, Rachel, for this important information. And check out our One Book, One College website to see what's up and coming in the spring as well. We will be